There's nothing out there that should be sacred, whether that's education or Medicaid or any other program out there.
House Speaker Mike Chenault says nothing's off the table this session. From the Alaska Public Radio Network, this is Alaska News Nightly for Tuesday, January 19th. Good evening, I'm Lori Townsend. Also tonight, Senator Murkowski is frustrated with Iranian oil potential.
We will, as a country, tell Iran, go ahead, produce more. Well, at the same time, we're going to continue locking up our potential.
Today's broadcast of Alaska News Nightly is presented by ConocoPhillips, investing in oil and gas production and creating economic opportunities for Alaskans. ConocoPhillips, Alaska's oil and gas company. The Older Persons Action Group is the publisher of the monthly Senior Voice newspaper and the 2016 Directory for Older Alaskans. To order the directory or to learn more, go to seniorvoicealaska.com. This message sponsored by OPAG.
The Alaska legislative session started today in Juneau. The Senate gaveled in at 11 a.m. and House Speaker Republican Mike Chenault started things off for the House at 1 p.m.
Let's do it that way. House, please come to order. Would members please indicate their presence by voting?
Lawmakers have a lot of work ahead of them as they address the state's massive budget deficit. We're talking with legislative leaders this week about what they want to accomplish this session. Chenault says he's focused on trimming the budget, but doesn't have a target number for cuts.
I don't have an exact number, but we're in a position that we've never been in before where our revenue stream dropped 88% over a period of a year and a half. And, so I think it's going to call for drastic measures, not only within the budget itself, but also looking at those revenue streams and deciding which may move Alaska ahead without some of the conflicts that may arise.
The governor and his team really feel that we need to solve this budget problem this year before the state's savings accounts are depleted. Do you look at the problem the same way, or do you think we have more time to figure this out?
You know, I think that it's important that we address the issue. Whether we do that all in one step this year or whether we do that over a couple of years remains to be seen, but I think it is an issue that we do need to address.
Are there any income taxes or other taxes that you would consider supporting?
You know, I think a lot depends on what that would be. I would be more apt to probably support a sales tax versus an income tax. But, I'm open to looking at each of the taxes that the governor's proposed and determining is that best for the state of Alaska or not, or best for the constituents in my district.
Do you think lawmakers will end up tapping the permanent fund earnings this session?
50-50 right now would be my guess.
And if so, how will you sell that to your constituents? What are you hearing from them?
Well, what I hear from my constituents is that they would like to see a smaller government to begin with. Then they would be open to looking at use of the permanent funds or an income tax or any of the other revenue-generating proposals, but first they would like to see a smaller, more leaner, responsible government.
And do you have ideas about where those cuts should come from?
You know, I think we're going to have to look at actual programs. I think that, there's nothing out there that should be sacred, whether that's education or Medicaid or any other program out there. I can tell you back during the Knowles administration, we actually went in and took out PCN numbers of employees just to get rid of certain, we ended up with having no deputy commissioners. We didn't have public relations people in every one of the departments. There were a number of things that we did to try to trim that budget down. I don't agree with across-the-board cuts because you end up keeping programs running that may not be as efficient as they could be, and you end up getting rid of the greater operators instead of a middle management person sitting in an office someplace around the state.
Are you concerned about cuts going so deep within state government that it might cause kind of the unintended consequence of harming the economy even more, since state government drives so much of the economy here?
Well, I think that we have to be concerned about that. Nobody wants to go back to the 80s when oil prices were at $8 a barrel and people were walking out of their house and throwing the keys on the desk at the banker and saying, you know, we can't make the payments. Nobody wants to see that, but also we have to be concerned that if we spend all of our reserves, then that lowers the opportunities and the that we have to get out of this thing unscathed. And I think that we need to be very careful of what we do and how we reduce the budget in order to get to that $3.9 billion deficit number.
House Speaker Mike Chenault is a Republican from Nikiski. Tune in tomorrow for a conversation with House Minority Leader Chris Tuck. The deficit of at least $3.5 billion has state leaders considering proposed solutions that would tap the earnings of Alaska's permanent fund and reduce the permanent fund dividend. As lawmakers debate the future of these two Alaskan institutions, APRN's Rachel Waldholtz looks back at why they were created in the first place.
This story starts in 1968. That's when Humble Oil and ARCO announced they had struck oil on state land in Prudhoe Bay, and Alaska officially became a major oil state. But it really gets interesting in 1969, with the lease sale at Prudhoe Bay. The auction brought in $900 million.
Which is a pretty big deal, since the budget was like $100 million just recently. Then you have $900 million in one day. You can imagine the excitement.
That's attorney Cliff Groh, who worked on PFD legislation in the 80s. Nobody had expected the sale to bring in that much. And yet, by the mid-70s, the money was gone.
A substantial number of people in Alaska felt it had been frittered away, wasted, or to use a blunter term, pissed away.
Groh doesn't think the money was wasted. It was spent on services, especially education, in what was, at that point, a new and poor state. But the perception that Alaska's first oil bonanza had been wasted lent strength to a group of lawmakers who wanted the state to save some of its oil wealth. Among them was Jay Hammond, elected governor in 1974.
You've got to remove the money, put it behind a rope where you cannot utilize it for flamboyant expenditures.
That's Hammond speaking in 1980. Even before the Trans-Alaska Pipeline was built, lawmakers were debating what to do with the coming windfall. Hammond and others argued that some of it must be put away. But they couldn't agree on what it should be put away for. A lot of ideas were thrown out.
Ranging from dams to daycare centers, literally. And, you know, and some people did say, save it for a rainy day. But that was not the official statement that was offered.
Groh stresses that one thing really wasn't a part of the conversation, a permanent fund dividend.
There was a reference to cash payments thrown out as one part of it. But it was also in there with dams, daycare centers, and rainy day fund.
One thing lawmakers could agree on, some portion of oil money should be taken off the table. Elmer Rasmussen chaired the fund's first board of trustees, and he said the permanent fund had a negative purpose. Just don't spend the money now. For Hammond, one purpose was clear. He later wrote, "I wanted to transform oil wells pumping oil for a finite period into money wells pumping money for infinity." And he had another idea in mind, the dividend check. If the permanent fund had many parents, the PFD was Hammond's baby. Why did Hammond want it so much?
Because it gave to everybody, from the poorest to the richest, a fair share of the money that they actually own.
Clem Tillion was one of Hammond's allies in the legislature during the fight for the permanent fund. Once the fund was created, Tillion says Hammond saw the dividend as a way to build a constituency to protect it.
Dividend was designed to make the people aware that it's their money, that this is a share of what their money earns, not a fixed amount. That's a welfare check.
Hammond's original idea was that people would receive more dividends the longer they'd stayed in state. The Supreme Court threw out that idea as unconstitutional. As a 27-year-old aide in the legislature, Cliff Groh helped design the backup plan, an equal payment to every Alaskan. That's the dividend we have today. In addition to protecting the fund, Groh says the dividend's creators had several things in mind.
Jay Hammond was also concerned about what we would now today call crony capitalism.
Hammond worried that oil money would flow through government programs to the well-connected, and he wanted to make sure some of the money made it out to rural Alaska instead of remaining concentrated in the rail belt. Most of all, he believed Alaskans should have a direct share of their collective oil wealth, a concept he called Alaska Inc. From the Energy Desk, I'm Rachel Waltholz in Anchorage.
Oil prices may continue their slide, but a top government energy economist predicts the price of crude will rise to $40 a barrel by the end of this year and to $50 a barrel by the end of next year.
Can we have $30 a barrel oil continuing indefinitely into the future? And I think the answer to that is no.
Adam Siminski, head of the U.S. Energy Information Administration, testified in Washington today at a hearing of the Senate Energy Committee. Siminski, though, added a big caveat to his forecast.
The uncertainty in crude oil prices as we look out over the next year or two is very high.
One of the unknowns is how much Iran will ramp up production. Initial forecasts are 500,000 barrels per day. Siminski says that could rise above 3 million barrels a day by the end of the year. Oil market analyst Antoine Hoff of Columbia University agrees Iranian leaders are eager to sell more.
But they've also said they don't want to crush the market. They don't want to flood the market too quickly with too much oil and cause the price to fall even further.
It's also unclear, Hoff says, how much international investment will flow to Iran. Energy Committee Chairman Lisa Murkowski warns she'll be fuming about U.S.-Iran policy all year.
This whole discussion about Iran is just so galling as a representative from a state that has enormous potential. We will, as a country, tell Iran, go ahead, produce more. Well, at the same time, we're going to continue locking up our potential.
Siminski says he expects U.S. crude production to fall through most of 2017, but he says it's price, not policy, that is driving domestic production down. Still to come on Alaska News Nightly, anger over the prospect of moving a Veterans Wall Memorial Wall in Wasilla.
That wall was built for veterans. And veterans have been maintaining it.
That's ahead. Stay with us.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by your local public radio station. Artists make us think and question. They excite and engage. Artists inspire Alaska. The 2016 Rasmussen Foundation Individual Artist Awards Grant Program is now accepting applications. Individual Artist Awards support Alaska artists in 10 creative disciplines at all career stages. The program is open to Alaska residents only. For details and to apply, visit rasmussen.org/IAA. The deadline is March 1st, 2016. This message sponsored by the Rasmussen Foundation.
The Northwest Arctic Borough's largest private employer and source of revenue is suing the borough over a recent hike in taxes. Tech Alaska, the operator of Red Dog Mine, filed the legal complaint on Friday, stating the tax increase could put jobs and economic activity in the region at risk. KNOM's Emily Russell has the story.
Red Dog is the world's second largest producer of zinc, situated 80 miles north of Kotzebue inland from the Chukchi Sea. Tech has been the mine's operator since it opened in 1989, and Wayne Hall, the mine's manager of community and public relations, says it's been a success, not just for the mine, but for the borough as well.
We've been in operation for 25 years. It's really truly an Alaskan success story. Mine's created enormous benefits to the region, including hundreds of millions in funding for schools and other services, as well as over 700 well-paying jobs.
The hundreds of millions that have helped fund schools and other services for the borough have come from what's called a payment in lieu of taxes, or PILT agreement. Tech has negotiated a PILT agreement with the Northwest Arctic Borough for the past 25 years.
However, this year, the borough has abandoned that collaborative process and instead levied what's referred to as a severance tax.
The last time a new PILT was negotiated was 5 years ago, when the borough doubled it, resulting in an average annual payment from Tech of $11.5 million. The new severance tax could nearly triple that, putting Tech on the line for an estimated $30 to $40 million each year. Hall says that could put the mine and the borough in jeopardy.
The fact is this tax increase will make Red Dog less competitive and create uncertainty around the longevity of the mine, potentially affecting the jobs and economic opportunities it creates.
According to the mine's website, Red Dog has historically provided the Northwest Arctic Borough with up to 80% of its revenue. It also directly employs over 600 people on site, with an annual payroll of $75 million. Along with direct impacts, Hall warns that the tax hike could also have a ripple effect in the region.
For example, we use a lot of air carrier services to bring our employees in from all 11 communities in the Northwest Arctic region. Those flights, we've got flights 3 times a week on minimum. That's just one example.
Those air carrier services, along with other mine-related services, create over more than 100 additional jobs for the region. So with so much at stake for both the mine and the borough, why the sudden surge in taxes?
We don't know, and we actually asked why, and they refused to tell us.
Calls to the Northwest Arctic Borough's mayor's office were not returned as of Monday afternoon, though the borough's regional corporation was willing to comment. Nana owns the land the mine operates on, and many of its shareholders work at Red Dog. Liz Carvalho is Nana's director of community and government affairs.
What Nana's concerned about are the shareholder jobs at the mine site. We're concerned about dividends to our shareholders, and we're concerned about future exploration in the region.
She says Nana is working to bring both parties to the table to renegotiate a payment agreement, something Hall would like to see as well.
We've really initiated this legal complaint very reluctantly. It wasn't something we wanted to do. Unfortunately, by refusing to engage in good faith negotiations, the borough has left us with few options. And our goal of this action is to get the borough to come to the table and work with us to negotiate a new and reasonable payment agreement.
Through the legal complaint, Tech is seeking an injunction of the severance tax and a meeting between Tech and the Northwest Arctic Borough. Reporting in Nome, I'm Emily Russell.
The National Park Service is proposing a regulatory change that would allow subsistence users to collect animal parts and plants for use in arts and crafts. Using caribou antlers as an example, NPS Alaska spokesman John Quinley says hunting would no longer be the only way to get them.
If you found caribou antlers that had been shed or from a natural mortality like a wolf kill, it has not been legal for them to take those antlers, and this fixes that sort of strange lineup of existing rules.
The change is among several NPS proposals out for public comment. Another would limit the types of bait used to attract and kill bears to natural foods.
Fish or wildlife remains, and it would eliminate things like dog food and stale bread.
Quinley says the change is aimed at decreasing likelihood of bears being attracted to human foods. Another proposed regulation would ban collection of living creatures.
And this stems from a handful of requests from the public to take falcon chicks. And that's an action that's under certain circumstances authorized by the state of Alaska and the Fish and Wildlife Service.
Quinley says the regulation clarifies that although the activity is available to permitted falconers on some state and federal lands, it's illegal in Alaska's national parks and preserves. Public comment on all the proposals is being accepted until April 12th.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by
the 2016 statewide BP Teachers of Excellence program. Teacher nomination forms are available at bpteachers.com. Alaska's Tobacco Quitline reminds you that 88% of Alaskans don't allow smoking in their home. A smoke-free environment helps prepare kids for a healthier life and a future free from tobacco. And it makes good economic sense. Secondhand smoke damages property, decreasing its value. Exposure to its toxins lead to disease and increased medical costs. Call 1-800-QUIT-NOW or enroll online at alaskaquitline.com. This message sponsored by Alaska's Tobacco Quitline.
A planned senior care project near Wasilla has hit a wall, literally. The design for the specialized nursing complex intrudes on space now occupied by the Veterans Wall of Honor Memorial, and some local veterans say they are not backing down in their stand against moving the wall. Alaska Public Media's Ellen Lockyer has more.
It's a complicated Matanuska-Susitna Barrow land use issue. At last week's Barrow Assembly meeting, Doug Clegg, representing Idaho-based Spring Creek Investments, updated the Assembly on his company's plan to buy land the Barrow is selling for its proposed specialized nursing services complex to house chronically ill seniors. Barrow manager John Moosey says the 108-unit, $10 million senior care complex is something that is needed in the Valley so that families with elderly members needing special care can stay in the Barrow. Clegg's company and the Barrow have entered into a contract on 4.5 acres located near the Mat-Su Regional Hospital, land that will be used to build the complex designed specifically for elders who need physical or dementia nursing care. Clegg showed the Assembly architect's renderings of the proposed building and its surrounding views. He said the Veterans Honor Wall, now located on the property, would be better moved to a different site on the property.
Relocating the monument to the northwest corner is the highest elevation and provides the greatest view. And if that's where we're recommending that the VA monument be relocated to.
Clegg said one of the challenges to viewing the wall where it stands now is accessibility, since it is a distance from available parking. He said moving it would put it closer to parking and give visitors a better view of the mountains. And he said developers would respect the wishes of the veterans concerning the wall.
And in saying that, I have to qualify that and say that we have a great interest in protecting the integrity of what the wall represents. And that means that if those that are involved in that legacy have a desire to make changes, we support it. If they have a desire to do something different than that and they choose to take it somewhere else, then we support it.
But some veterans are adamant about not moving the wall at all.
This is a landmark. We don't want it moved. That's sacred ground.
That's Wasilla former Marine Dino Bellegatti.
That wall was built for veterans. And veterans have been maintaining it. Every year it goes to a different post to present at Memorial Day and Veterans Day. We're the ones doing it.
Bellegatti protested that veterans groups had not been invited to talks about the land purchase or the development. Borough attorney Nick Spiropoulos says the land purchase agreement contains a clause that states the Veterans Wall will remain on the property, but the agreement is complicated by the fact that neither the borough nor Spring Creek owns the wall, so neither entity can move it. The owners of the wall can, but actual ownership of the memorial is vague. State records indicate a nonprofit corporation, the Area-Wide Community Services Council, owns the memorial. The Area-Wide Community Services Council incorporated in 2002 with now State Senator Charles Huggins listed as president of the corporation. Huggins remained president through 2011. Since then, the corporation has dissolved a couple of times but was reinstated most recently in October of 2014 with new directors and John Schwaltz of Wasilla named as president of the corporation. After a meeting last week, Schwaltz says that negotiations with Spring Creek are cordial but inconclusive at this point.
If we get enough room that we can hold our ceremonies, you better believe it. We don't want to move it. If it has to be moved but stay up in that area that they have, beautiful. It's all we ask. But it has to be to our liking, too.
Another meeting with Spring Creek is scheduled for February with four veterans groups and Schwaltz. The Schwaltz family has been caretaking the wall for about 20 years. John Schwaltz says it is important that the wall, which holds the names of living and dead veterans, keeps its view of Pioneer Peak and the nearby Mount POW/MIA. I'm Ellen Lockyer.
The Federal Subsistence Board voted last week to work to reestablish better relations with the state of Alaska. As KMBA's Jacqueline Estes reports, a federal-state memorandum of understanding on subsistence expired last year over differences on data sharing, day-to-day operations, and other issues.
The agencies that make up the Federal Subsistence Board agreed last year to disagree with the state of Alaska on subsistence management. Federal laws dictate protection of wildlife and preservation of natural conditions and processes in national parks and wildlife refuges. Meanwhile, the Palin and Parnell administrations had embraced an intensive management approach that involves manipulating habitat and killing predators to increase harvestable prey. U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service Regional Director Jeff Haskett told other board members the time is right to work on a new MOU.
So I think the board should fully support this. I think we're in a different time now than we were couple years ago when we weren't able to have much in the way of constructive discussions with the state on this. I think the timing's right for us to send a letter from the board requesting the state to begin those discussions anew. And I think the chances for a positive outcome are pretty good right now.
And, said Daniel Sharp, subsistence coordinator for the Alaska Office of the Bureau of Land Management, federal agencies need to iron out differences with the state before they bring tribes into management of fish and game.
It's going to be difficult for a co-management scenario to be successful if the feds and the states can't have an MOU to agree. If we're not going to do much better to bring a third party in when the first two parties aren't necessarily in alignment or agreement.
In other actions, the board directed staff to begin to develop policies and perhaps seek secretarial executive orders to bolster new regulations for deciding which communities fit the rural designation that makes subsistence a priority use. The board's endorsements were guided by technical committees of biologists and anthropologists and regional subsistence advisory councils, or RACs. Haskett, who's retiring in a few months, says giving greater weight to the voices of those most affected by decisions is the change he has seen during his tenure on the board.
I'm very sad to be leaving the board. I've been doing it for 8 years now. It's gone through a lot of changes. One of the things that's been really good is that I think our record speaks for itself. About 98% of the time we support what the RAC recommendations are. The RACs don't always agree, so sometimes there's concerns there, but I think that we work really, really hard to make sure that we're addressing conservation issues, same time making sure we support subsistence use out there. So it's been really an honor to be able to work on this board.
The Federal Subsistence Board is soliciting applications to serve on regional subsistence councils with a due date of January 29th. Reporting in Anchorage, I'm Jocelyn Estes.
That's all for this edition of Alaska News Nightly. Tonight's stories can be found at alaskapublic.org. You can also follow us on Twitter at APRN. We had reports tonight from Rachel Waldholtz and Jocelyn Estes in Anchorage, Annie Fite and Andrew Kitchenman in Juneau, Emily Russell in Nome, Dan Bross in Fairbanks, and Ellen Lockyer in Wasilla. Our audio engineer is Dave Waldron. Monica Gokey is our web editor. And I'm Lori Townsend. Have a great evening.
Alaska News Nightly was made possible by
Raven Alaska, offering passenger, cargo, and same-day package delivery to over 100 communities across Alaska. Find more at flyraven.com. The Red Dog Mine, committed to environmental excellence.
And by
Condor Airlines, with nonstop service from Ted Stevens International Airport to Germany and beyond. More information available on condor.com. Condor, born to fly.
At the Salmon Project, they know that Alaskan lives are salmon lives. Join them this winter as they journey across the state and hear the stories of Alaskans whose lives are amazingly similar to yours, even if they live 2,000 miles away. Learn more at salmonlife.org. This message sponsored by the Salmon Project.
This is APRN, the Alaska Public Radio Network.